We are pleased to welcome back to the studio Catherine Austin Fitz to take us deep into the weeds of a financial coup that over the past three decades has seen more than $21 trillion stolen from the American people, and how that relates to plans for depopulation. And what would you say if I told you that America is the global leader in money laundering? My name is Kevin Kukagee, and with my good friend Gary Humble, this is the Freedom Matters Podcast.
Oh, hey, well, okay. Nice.
You recognize that voice?
Please, God.
You don't know this voice? Classic American voice?
Isn't this Fred?
Sorry, man. Horrible.
Nope. It's not Fred.
Okay.
But Fred often danced when he was singing.
I'm just glad someone else missed it.
It's Bing Crosby.
It's Bing Crosby, okay. Yeah.
An American classic.
Yeah.
Okay, I don't expect you to know this name, but do you know this songwriter, composer?
No, definitely not.
So his name is Harry Warren, but that's only his stage name. He was actually an Italian by the name of Salvatore Antonio Guaragna, if I'm pronouncing that correctly.
No wonder he wanted a stage name.
Yeah, but he wrote all these classics. I Only Have Eyes for You,
wow.
Jeepers Creepers, That's Amore, At Last, and even, for Tennesseans, the Chattanooga Choo Choo.
Really?
Yeah.
Wow.
So, Gary, we're not in the money, but we're certainly in the presence of someone who knows a heck of a lot about money.
Yeah.
And in a few minutes, we're going to pivot to our special guest, who, by the way, Catherine Austin Fitz, you now tie Kathy Harms for the third personal appearance.
I was just thinking that.
Yeah, which is the most on a Tennessee Stands podcast.
Really? Wow.
So I think that should get some claps, Mr. Producer.
Wonderful. All right. Welcome.
But Gary, before we go there, have you seen the news? Oh my, the local news.
No, but you said something about Ford.
Oh my gosh. Here's the headline from Blaze Timeline. Let's see, the author's name is Paul Sacca. Writes a lot of these pieces in Blaze Media.
Well, I did see that they're delaying delivery until 2027. Does that have something to do with that?
Yeah, so it's even bigger than that, but that's the particular point that relates to Tennessee. So the headline is Ford kills electric SUV as EV division is on pace to lose $5.5 billion this year.
Of course it is.
And as we've mentioned this three or four times over the past year, Ford keeps announcing all the money that they're losing. And the problem is they're losing money, including this T3. So Blue Oval City, which was established with the really, if there's anything that's Bill Lee's legacy, it's not education. It's this boondoggle.
It's this failure.
Yeah,
yes.
This Blue Oval City. So there's
who, by the way, he called a special session for, but refused to call a special session to protect the liberties under the COVID pandemic.
And I'm so glad you said that, because I have something to read into the record about that. But Ford is, so this plant is supposed to open up in 2025, and yet Ford has announced that the truck won't even be ready till 2027.
Mm-hmm.
So we're going to twiddle our thumbs like this, you know, theater of the mind, our audience can see this, but I'm sitting here twiddling my thumbs for Gary and Catherine. Wasted time, wasted money. We've been saying this over and over and over again. Talk about a bridge to nowhere. Right? This is Bill Lee's legacy. And yet, Gary, and I don't know if you've heard this, but it's come to my attention recently, and to my disappointment, that some of our Christian brothers here in Tennessee have recently taken to admonishing anyone who refers to Bill Lee as a rhino.
Oh, no. Well, we got to admonish Trump, too. Surely they're admonishing him.
Suggesting that he is one of us, despite the fact that his entire tenure as governor has been marked by bad fruit after bad fruit. From his notable hire of a known leftist education commissioner, Penny Schwinn, right off the bat, to spending millions of taxpayer dollars on slick and smug PR stunt, remember, to shame you if you weren't wearing a mask?
Face it, Tennessee. Mask up.
How about his arrogant persistence and never apologizing for the quote-unquote safe and effective mantra, long after Big Pharma bait and switch was proven to be neither safe nor effective. So we have an abundance of evidence about the character of this governor's tree. When Paul Vaughn and other believers from the state of Tennessee were subjected to persecution and dubious prosecution under the FACE Act for praying and singing at an abortion clinic, Bill Lee was silent. But okay, we won't call him a rhino. Let's call him what he is. I think rhino is too charitable. I think we shall refer to him as a statist. But so that we may be clear, since the governor of the state of Tennessee claims to believe what we believe, then we as Christians have an obligation to call him to repentance because he is not governing consistent with the word of God. He professes to know God, but he denies him by his works, Titus 1:16, accepting, among other things, the big lie and recommending that believers not meet together in person. Remember that. He disobeys the governing authorities, which in America are the people. He unequally yokes us, 2 Corinthians 6, with unbelievers without our consent, literally taking hundreds of millions of dollars from the people and giving it, along with our sovereignty, to Ford, a globalist corporation whose well-known views on human nature and rebellion against the created order are visibly and demonstrably inconsistent with a Christian worldview. We are not to blithely celebrate an agent of the people, giving face value to his words or his intentions, even if you believe they're in good faith. Shakespeare wrote, and my children memorized this, "The devil can cite scripture for his purpose. An evil soul producing holy witness is like a villain with a smiling cheek, a goodly apple rotten at the heart. Oh, what a goodly outside falsehood hath." So my admonition to the church and to any pastor in Tennessee who might be tempted to give cover to this governor is that we must never lend our credibility, the credibility of the gospel, to any political figure. Like the Bereans, we must examine the scriptures daily to see if what the governor says and does is true, Acts 17. The Bible tells us that by their fruits you will know them, Matthew 7:20. And it would appear, Gary, that Blue Oval City and nearly every intention behind it is rotten to the core. Now, the discerning among us knew this long before that tree was ever planted. May no one ever eat its fruit again. And having dispensed with that merry message, Catherine, welcome back.
Yeah, that made up for all of the episodes that we did not do. You know, what would I do if I were governor?
That's right. We forgot about some of those.
And we had some really good ones. So that made up for all of that. And by the way, just on the Ford note, you know, when that special session was called and we were dealing with the employer mandates and the law that eventually, and this was the next week, so the governor calls the special session, we suspend rules to Ford, roughly $1 billion to Ford, and then the next week, the General Assembly calls themselves into session to deal with the COVID mandates. And the law that eventually went on the books restricted employers from mandating a shot for COVID, which we appreciate. However, the initial bill that was drafted that was making its way to the floor would have restricted the requirements of masks as well as a medical treatment. And it was Ford. That was the very first act of Ford. As soon as they got the sign off on the $1 billion, the next week when they heard that that was heading to the floor, they made a phone call and petitioned against that and basically used their position as if they had a position. We're giving them $1 billion. But the message was, if you restrict corporations from being able to issue these mask mandates, we're pulling out of Tennessee.
You're kidding.
And not only did we give them $1 billion, what did the legislature do? Well, they pulled it out of the bill. First act of the Ford Motor Company here in Tennessee.
So if anyone ever says, oh, you make too much of this, they won't do, and then fill in the blanks. The very first thing they do is impede your liberties, and you can see the influence. And so now we've got a boondoggle, and as a result of our money, not only does our money go to this boondoggle, but not that we're under COVID restrictions now, but the fact is, if they ever want to raise their rear its ugly head again, we're at risk of only being protected from the jab mandate and not the mask mandate.
Right? Yeah, but you're missing the big point. If we invested $1 billion in building up the businesses on Main Street, do you know the incredible explosion of growth without inflation we'd get?
Wouldn't that be something?
Yeah. So you're taking money out of something that has a fantastically positive return on investment. You're taxing those people rather than investing them, and you're moving in something that has a negative return on investment. It's like a tapeworm.
Yep.
Right. So welcome to the tapeworm economy. Thank you, Governor.
and that voice you hear is the voice of our financial expert, Catherine Austin Fitz. Welcome back to talk about all of those things.
It's always a pleasure, but, you know, I have to start with a compliment, okay? So, Gary, I get the feeling you don't like compliments, so just hold on.
No, everybody likes compliments.
You're going to have to take this. So I was working in the legislature, and we're working on financial transaction freedom, and this huge package comes in for the UCC, you know, almost 100 pages of reforms to the UCC. And I'm talking with legislatures and lobbyists, and no one understands it. No one understands it. Yeah. No one understands it. And I said, look, you can't pass a bill with all these provisions related to money that's been written by somebody from out of state, and you don't understand it, and you don't know it. You can't do that. And everybody kept telling me, look, it's a fait accompli. There's nothing you can do to stop this. So then Gary writes a fabulous article, and I think you did an interview, where you just communicated why you can't do this. And it worked. It caught on. And the bill got killed. And you made a major contribution to that.
He needs I think that deserves more claps again.
Oh, well, thank you. Very kind.
But, you know, it was, you know, I'm always hearing, oh, well, there's nothing you can do about that. Mm-hmm. But there is something you can do, and you did it, and it really helped a lot.
Well, thank you for that. That means a lot, you saying that. We had, you know, put out some media videos, did write a commentary or two on this, and we had thousands of Tennesseans, thankfully, that got concerned about the issue, took action, and reached out to their legislators.
Right.
And this was a bill, by the way, this was a two-year effort. We fought it. Our General Assembly goes for 2 years. The bill was filed in 2023. We fought that, and the success in 2023 was that they tabled it, but the bill came back in 2024. And interestingly, not only did the bill die, it actually did pass, but what they did was they put a one-page amendment.
Right.
And so they took a 72-page omnibus bill that I believe was very threatening to currency, and also, I believe, begin to set the regulatory
freedom
scheme of a central bank digital currency. But anyway, that whole thing was scrapped, and now we've got a one-pager that passed that simply says that the state of Tennessee will not recognize a central bank digital currency. So
right.
I was like, yes, success. That was great. Thank you for
that. Although our danger is financial transaction control, which can happen in many ways. It doesn't need a central bank digital currency.
So with that, you know, we're coming off of a conversation, a very, I think for some, maybe still confusing conversation. I think folks are still trying to wrap their minds around cryptocurrencies, bitcoins, blockchain, how all of this works. But a really great conversation with Dave Birdbaum on kind of the technology behind why he feels Bitcoin is trustworthy as a stored value and taking us into the future of being able to transact free from centralized control. So, I know you're a hard assets person, gold and silver. I think many of our listeners are too. But I would love to hear, as you talk about financial transaction freedom, your view on how does it, and even if Bitcoin should, in your opinion, play a part in that future.
Okay, so my goal, what I want is when I leave today, that you both have a framework for how money and financial system fits into the whole governance system, and you see where Bitcoin or any kind of crypto might fit in, and how it can be used for good and evil. So, and it's not that any financial product can be used well or it can be used poorly, and so it's important to remember that it's how you use it.
Yeah.
Okay. So the first thing I would say is, and I know you guys understand this, we have a governance problem. And you cannot solve a governance problem with a financial product.
Okay. Great point.
Okay. But there's a lot of people trying to do that.
Yeah.
You know, because I like to solve problems with what I can control. You know, and I can build a financial product, I can trade a financial product, I can make money on a financial product, but it won't solve a governance problem. You know, and if I take a financial system and a series of currencies and products, and I, you know, I put the people in charge who are corrupt and untrustworthy, system's not going to work. So it's really important to separate financial products from the discussion of government.
So are you saying that in terms of regardless of what the financial product might be, it would be dependent upon how the government may or may not regulate that financial product, that that's the real issue. Is that sort of what you're alluding to?
And how we use it. Okay, so let's, I'm gonna start with the basics and get back to Bitcoin. We have a governance system, and that governance system is governed with laws. So in the United States, we have constitution, and then we have laws underneath that, and then we have regulations underneath that. Okay. And if you look at our governance structure, there's much about our governance structure that's very good if we would follow it. Okay. So what we know, and we know that part of that governance structure is the financial system. Now, in any financial system of the kind we have, it is a product of laws. Okay. It's a product of contracts. It's a product of, I can use hard assets and commodities for a currency, or I can just have a fiat currency like the dollar. But if the government is corrupt and breaks all the laws all the time, nothing will work. A financial system depends on the rule of law and depends on enforcement in the rule of law, and markets depend on trust in the rule of law because the rule of law really works, okay? So if you look at the dollar system for the last, since mid-90s, we've been in a financial coup. And the federal government has been violating all the laws related to financial management. So failure to disclose, $21 trillion disappeared out the back door until they changed the laws that where they said, as a matter of administrative policy, we don't have to obey any of the financial management laws. We're going to keep the whole thing dark. And not only that, keep the corporations and banks and other entities we do business with, take them dark as well. So we're going to have a non-disclosed secret market. So you can't, in other words, that's the problem. And you can't solve that problem by saying, you know something, we're going to come out with private currencies that are completely dark as well and think that's going to solve the problem. Now, I'm a bit of a libertarian, so I love private currencies. And I would love to see private currencies thrive and happen. I'd love to see community currencies. But when you are operating in a governance structure with significant criminality and criminality funded with $21 trillion plus that's already been stolen, and you let them play with all these different financial products, you're going to get a mess, okay? And you can get a mess with Bitcoin. You can get a mess with hard assets and gold and silver. So, for example, have you had any of the Sound Money gold guys on the show?
No.
We've not.
Okay.
No.
So I describe it this way, and I've said this to them when I've met with them because they've been in Nashville lobbying for these systems. And I said, okay, so there's $21 trillion missing from the federal government. And as that money went missing, the central banks have basically bought up all the gold. And everybody in Tennessee now has their bank accounts and their various accounts full of dollars, right? So we've got dollars and they've got gold. And now you think we're going to solve our problems by starting a currency that requires us to get our gold from them. They have it. We don't. We're over a barrel. You're just going to make them more powerful. Now, I'd love to see the state have a bullion depository and be able to invest in gold and silver. But you have to look at this through the prism of economic warfare. So, you know, we can propose all sorts of solutions that are simply going to give our enemies more power than they have now. So I'd be perfectly happy to use, you know, in a prison, use cigarettes as currency. Believe it or not, when the wall came down after the Soviet Union collapsed, do you know what the best currency was?
What?
Vodka.
Of course.
Don't laugh. I have all these little bottles, you know, and I'm a prepper. So I have, in Hickory Valley, I have stacks of these cartons with little, you know, little whiskey.
Like airplane, bottles. Airline vodkas?
Yeah, because they last forever. Anyway, so I don't think it would be vodka here. I think it would be, you know.
Well, bourbon.
Yeah.
Bourbon and whiskey. Yeah. I was actually talking to one of the guys in the office last week about something. This came up, and we're like, man, wouldn't it be something if maybe whiskey was a currency again? You know, we'd be doing
it. It would. Don't laugh. But anyway, so So one of the things you have to ask when you fiddle around with the financial system is, what are we trying to accomplish? And you can't solve the lawlessness or the corruption with saying, okay, we're going, whether it's gold or silver or Bitcoin, we're going to make these assets generally required for trading and for transactions. Because if you look at who owns and controls those assets right now, it's a relatively small portion of the population, and you'll advantage them tremendously and disadvantage everyone else for no reason. Does that make sense?
Yeah. Okay. You mean as far as like making it legal tender?
Well, for example, I don't know if you saw the speeches at Bitcoin 2024.
I didn't get a chance to see those.
Okay.
I actually had an invitation to go to that, and I couldn't go.
There's a commentary up at Solari where I listed 18 questions for Kennedy, who made very specific policy recommendations, most of which in my book are illegal. But basically, he was proposing to take significant amounts of taxpayers' money and use it to buy Bitcoin and put Bitcoin in the treasury as an asset.
Wow.
Yeah, so depending on how you would estimate the run-up in price, you're basically taking a small group of people out of their Bitcoin in a way that runs the price up tremendously. You're funding it with the tax collections.
With their own money.
Yeah. No. So if you look at who owns Bitcoin, you'll see some surveys that say 20% of the population. But if you look at the concentration, anybody with a meaningful position is much smaller percent. When you take taxpayers' money, you're taking 100% of the citizens and their retirement savings, because most of that money is not just coming from taxes, it's coming out of their pension funds. So you're laundering money out of the pension funds, and you're buying Bitcoin in such a significant size that you're going to run the price up dramatically. So that small group of holders is going to be advantaged tremendously. And then what he proposed is that they could swap that. They could sell that on a non-reportable, non-taxable basis and swap it into real estate. So now you're having people's pension funds and their taxes of working people and poor people funding a tax-free land grab by the group of people who own Bitcoin. And if you look at, remember, Bitcoin is not a disclosed market. It's private. Dark.
Yeah.
Well, it's dark, so it's secret. Now, and there's all sorts of speculation. I can speculate on who I think still has the big positions in Bitcoin. But you're going to give a relatively small group of people a fantastic amount of money from the taxpayers to then and put it in a position where they can essentially grab a huge amount of land in this country.
That's concerning.
It's very concerning. Because I think here's where we are. So In the current system, what we've done is we've allowed a corrupt system to engineer more and more debt. And as that debt rises, the money disappears out the back door. It's a bank robbery, and it's the biggest bank robbery in history. And as that money disappears, that money is then used to create or buy up real assets. Now, that debt is many multiples of how much real assets there are. So we've got a financial system that's got extraordinary collateral fraud. Do you understand what I mean by
that? Yeah, it's backed by nothing.
Well,
it's numbers.
In other words, we have mortgage-backed securities that have more mortgages in them than there are homes.
Right.
Right.
The debt exceeds the actual assets
right.
that exist.
So I became convinced when I was Assistant Secretary of Housing that there were literally houses out there with 10 mortgages on one house.
Right.
Okay. So that's collateral fraud. Now, when you build a system that has that much collateral fraud, as the music begins to stop, what's the game? The game is grabbing the real assets, right?
And who gets to grab those?
Right. And that's one of the advantages of stealing all that money all this period, is now you've got the money stockpiled to grab. And that's what we saw during the pandemic. So let's just revisit the shock that we lived through in the pandemic. And I'm going to grossly oversimplify just to make it clear. Mm-hmm. So here's Wall Street and here's Main Street. And the central bankers go to Jackson Hole in August 2019. They vote on the Going Direct Reset. I think I gave you our magazine on Going Direct Reset. they come back to their desks in the fall and they begin to inject $5 trillion, most of it going to Wall Street. Okay, so now Wall Street has lots and lots of resources, right? So then they turn around and they say, okay, Main Street, you have to shut down. Okay, so now you've got to shut your store and you can't generate income. So these guys now have $5 trillion to go shopping. And these guys' businesses are shut down. And what happens? Huge market share gets sucked from Main Street into Wall Street. Mm-hmm. And we create lots of new, 500 new billionaires. The Oxfam just came out with a new study saying that the rich are now, I forget, it's like $40 trillion richer than they were the last time they did the study. Yeah, no, it's, you're talking about a giant sucking sound out of Main Street into Wall Street. Now, okay, so now these companies
Can you go back just for a second?
Yeah.
Who was it in the fall of 19 that gathered together, and whose money was it that went to Wall Street to the tune of $5 trillion?
So I gave you a copy of our Going Direct reset that we had John Titus write. It's an excellent description. So in August 2019, every August, it's happening right now, the G7 central bankers gather at Jackson Hole under the auspices of the Kansas City Fed, you know, to meet. They're different meetings monthly and yearly of the central bankers, and this is where they discuss and coordinate policies. And they were presented with a plan by a group of retired central bankers who had been working through the BlackRock Investment Institute on a plan called Going Direct. Going direct, the word going direct means injecting money. Instead of putting money into the reserve track so that it's available to support banks' lending, you inject money directly. And this was historically unheard of because when you inject money directly, you can very much steer who gets the money and how. Okay. And I think, did I send you our study on SPACs? Because that money was used to do several, you know what I mean by a pump and dump?
Yes.
Is used to do several pumps and dumps, but one of the pumps was SPACs. Do you know what a SPAC is?
I don't know what a SPAC is.
I remember talking about this, but I forget.
SPAC is a special purpose acquisition company. And you put out billions of dollars of blind pool money that can be directed specifically. So if I want to build electrical cars, because a lot went to electric cars, if I want to build the 5G towers and a control grid, a lot of the money went to building the control grid. So it's a way of pouring money into something that might not be economic if you didn't have that tsunami of subsidy.
So, but this was taxpayer, this is revenues.
No, this came from the central bank, okay?
But how did the central bank get it? I mean, ultimately.
So the central bank has the power, essentially, to create it out of thin air. It's a fiat currency, right?
So it wasn't real money. You're just saying it was
real money.
It's their real money.
It's real money.
But that they created, right?
If they're creating it, what value does it have?
So here's what value it has. So, you know, when you go in and you use that money to buy up all the market share from Main Street, put them on their ass by putting them, shutting them down.
Value.
And then you can buy their assets cheap. Because remember, a lot of guys had to sell their real estate or their assets or their business because they were in a corner.
Right.
So you can pick it up cheap. But here's how it's very real money. When I, you know, so the money is then, so one way the Fed can inject the money directly is they buy bonds from non-financial banks that aren't in the Fed system. So they're buying them from financial institutions. And then those institutions need, you know, something to go. They need to invest that money. Well, they invest. Now, here's how this turns into real money. Right after they voted on going direct and started to do this, I got a wonderful client who had an account in Switzerland. So I used to be an investment advisor and had a lot of clients who had money in Switzerland, sent me a private video of one of the former governors of the Federal Reserve, who was very good. His name is Larry Lindsey. I'm a great admirer of his. Of him, and sent me a speech by Larry Lindsey to the firm and their clients describing why inflation was going to skyrocket. Okay, now inflation didn't skyrocket until after the pandemic was essentially over. Now, why was that? Because when you shut down Main Street, your monetary inflation is offset with labor and other deflation. So if I give lots of money to my friends and I shut down my enemies in a way that creates a lot of labor deflation, mm-hmm. I offset the inflation for some period of time until when it's over, what happens? Inflation hits. Anybody notice their grocery bills are higher?
Course.
Okay. That's real money.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. When you have to pay three or four times, I think when I checked, I was looking at sort of the game on bird flu, and I realized year to date, as of maybe a month ago, the price of chicken was up 27%. That's real money.
Yeah.
Right. So when you come through the inflation, that's how you feel.
Yeah. No, So we're
which
clear.
Why is chicken only up 27%, but eggs are up 52%? Now, explain that.
Is that really the difference?
I haven't looked into that one. Everyone
which
I
came
know
first,
has chicken.
Chicken or the egg?
Or the egg. Wherever I go, I'm getting chicken. We're getting, you know, everybody's got their own chickens and we get our own eggs, so I don't.
Just to finish that circle or to close that circle, all I meant is it's not real money because they're printing it. Not that the impact isn't real money to your pocket and my pocket and what they can do with it, but you're saying that effectively they're just printing this money to inject for their friends so that their friends can then use it to buy real assets.
In this instance, they were injecting it to engineer a reset.
Mm-hmm.
So if you go back in history, every 80 to 120 years, we have a reset. And, you know, one thing we could use is a lot more research on exactly how resets work. Historically, plague laws have been very useful to help you do resets because they're very helpful in consolidating capital.
Mm-hmm.
So anyway, the reason I brought that up is that's an example of the governance system engineering purposefully a shock designed to re-engineer the economy.
No matter the currency.
I mean, I assure you, a group of people could take over the governance of the dollar tomorrow and do a great job, and the dollar could work just fine.
Hmm.
Right? So if you go back through history, the most efficient currencies, the best currencies, are fiat currencies that are well-governed and where there's tremendous transparency around the governance. Now, if you look at what's happened, because the dollar's been a marvelous fiat currency— but if you look at what's happened to the governance, it's been historically more and more secret, more and more non-transparent. Everybody in America was perfectly happy with that as long as they were making money and they got mm-hmm. their checks. So I hate to tell you, the general population support for organized crime and shenanigans and warfare has been very significant. Part of our problem is the chickens are coming home to roost mm-hmm. now. But the dollar has worked very well.
But when things are cheap and they can go on vacation or whatever, then go out to eat, they're fine.
Okay, so I'm going to have to skip. Hold this. We'll come back here. We keep skipping topic. I want to give you that perfect framework. Okay, so I had a wonderful meeting with a group of Idaho legislators. The Northern Idaho legislators are quite remarkable as a group. And they did a backcasting on the Salieri Report, and it's really worth watching. You might enjoy it. Do you know what a backcasting is?
Mm-hmm.
It's a planning exercise where you go into the future and you pretend you succeeded at what you wanted, and then you tell the story of how it happened.
Wow. Interesting.
Yeah. So we have a Salieri Report with five Idaho legislators talking about. Our tagline was, it's 2030, freedom reigns, Klaus Schwab is in a state of depression in a chalet in the Alps.
I don't think Klaus Schwab's going to be alive in 2030.
Probably not. Anyway, so one of them said to me, here's my problem. Every year we send a dollar to Washington and we get $1.19 back. And every time we try and enforce the Constitution, the message from our constituents is we want the 19 cents. So I'll give you a perfect example. A group of legislators this year tried to figure out how we could say no to federal education money, because I would say that accepting that money requires that you teach your children mm-hmm. and your grandchildren how to be sex slaves.
Yep.
Why would you do that?
Strings.
Mm-hmm. Better to turn that money down. We couldn't figure out how to, everybody wanted the money.
Yep.
Right.
We did that in Tennessee here too.
Right. So we have been, whether the money's coming through the fiscal tsunami or it's coming through the monetary tsunami, we have consistently allowed ourselves in a democratic republic to be bought off again and again by a little bit of money. And the reality is, as they build the control grid and they have more and more control, they don't have to share the money. And that's what they're doing. They're slowly withdrawing the sharing.
So I want to ask you another question that's going to get you off your framework discussion. But
I
want to take advantage of it because you're here. So last week, Klaus Schwab came out and said there's going to be, what were the words he used? Shock events between now and the election,
that was
right?
The word, yeah.
First of all, the arrogance to think that, you know, they've got this God complex to think that
they've designed all these shock events.
I know, but it still presumes that they have the power to carry them out. And
because, they do.
Well, they do, except under a sovereign God. When God says it's time
That's
to stop
true.
Acting, you're not going to be able to do this. But I was going to ask you, Catherine, in light of the fact that you said this group is meeting in August and they're meeting right now.
They're meeting right now.
What do you think that Schwab and this group are planning as shock events for us over these next couple of months before the election?
So you have these different, you know, lines. John Rappaport calls them cartels, the mm-hmm. health cartel. And so to do the going direct reset, the big shock they used first was health. Okay.
Right.
But it was clearly engineered. And the goal of the, you know, if the central bankers came along and said, look, we want to re-engineer how the whole economy works and the financial system and move to total control, and we're just going to do it, people would have jacked.
Right.
But if you say, oh, we have a magic virus and mm-hmm. you're all going to die and we're going to save you.
Right.
You know,
compliance. Yeah.
Right. You know. But they've been working on cybersecurity shocks. They've been working on a bird flu or monkeypox shock. They have been working on various financial shocks they could do. So I don't think those will be discussed at Jackson Hole. I mean, that might be. But they tend to keep, you know, sort of the central banking line separate from, that's where the intelligence agencies go off and help work with the different cartels to engineer the shock. We just did a series on the SLUR.
It's really important that our audience hear that again, because sometimes Gary and I we are accused of conspiracy theories and no evidence, and yet we know these things are happening. We understand there's been so much more exposure due to the work of RFK, despite, you know, your comments notwithstanding on Bitcoin issue.
No, he's done a very good job of bringing transparency.
Yes, to the intelligence agency's control. So say that once again. You just made reference to it, and you made it so plainly and matter-of-factly that I think some people, that would be a shock. Hopefully nobody that's listening to our podcast, but there are still some people who walk around with blinders who could never consider that, yes, our intelligence agencies commandeer elections and activity in other countries, but for some reason they think, when it comes to the United States, no, freedom reigns, and the intelligence agencies would never have anything to do with that. What did you mean when you said the intelligence agencies separate what the central banking is doing from the other shock?
Well, if you look at the shock of engineering a pandemic mm-hmm. and using a pandemic to create far more economic control, that takes a lot of planning. It's a big job. It's a lot of work to do that. And the intelligence agencies are always involved in the planning and the implementation. And they're far from the only group of people that are involved, but they're, you know, their job is covert operations, mm-hmm. and covert operations are clearly involved. Now, it's hard for me to talk about these things in the sense that I grew up in a world where everything, the way you built the future was one transaction at a time, and the way you designed and implemented those transactions were with conspiracies. Conspiracies were the ultimately... They were the fundamental operating model of what we did. And so I always find when I first got booted out of the establishment, when somebody talked about conspiracies in a pejorative way, I was like, are you kidding? You'll never have any power if you think conspiracies are bad. Conspiracies are wonderful. You know, that's how we get things done.
Mm-hmm.
So it was always shocking because I always told me, you know, I just said, look, I spent my whole life as a conspiracy foot soldier. You know, what do you mean they're terrible things?
So. And isn't it true that that term was coined by the intelligence agencies?
That's what I'm told, but I never researched
around
it.
Around the time of Kennedy's assassination.
I don't know. I come from a world where it was such an, you know, I don't know, it was like everybody did, you know, you did it from the youngest age and everybody did it. And it was the operating principle. And so I never, I don't know, it's hard. It's very hard for me to put myself in the head of somebody who would speak about conspiracies in a derogatory manner. And most conspiracies are legal. They're not illegal.
Mm-hmm.
You just, you know, we used to sneak around and, you know, to get anything done, you had to sneak around.
So setting aside the non-financial shocks, what do you think, what financial shock do you think is being established, is being worked on?
So the number one thing you need to get financial transaction control. And remember, that's our goal, is to stop financial transaction control. That's what Solari's goal is in working with state legislators. So we want to stop financial transaction control, and it's not just CBDC. You know, I can do complete financial transaction control with Visa and MasterCard. I don't need CBDC. So we want to stop financial transaction control. And the first and most important thing you need to get that, to get financial transaction control with a CBDC or anything else, is you need a digital ID. So here's how I'd get a digital ID if I was Mr. Global. So mm-hmm. I always like to put myself in his or her shoes, because that's kind of how I figure out what might be going on. I would get it by saying, first of all, I'd flood the country with immigrants.
Right.
And then I'd tell everybody I'd solve the immigration problem, but I needed a digital ID so I knew who was good and who was not and who to throw out. And if that didn't work, I'd tell you, you know, the only way to solve election fraud is to get a digital ID. So, you know, every time I rigged an election, I'd say, oh, you know, this would never have happened if we needed a digital ID. Mm-hmm. And I'd get all the conservatives in the heartland to go along with a digital ID using immigration and election fraud.
So it's interesting about that, because right now, not everybody's on board, even on the left, with digital ID, right? Because even though digital ID, they are okay with it in every other aspect of life, whether you're getting on an airplane, whether you're buying something, you know, through a web portal to confirm who you are at every step of the way. But when it comes to elections, of course, that's the one place where we can't have any kind of ID, digital or otherwise.
Well, but I look at this differently. So I hear what the candidates say, but then I hear about who they support. So I'll just be a bad guy here. You know, Trump says he's against CBDC, but if you look at the people who stole the $21 trillion and are engineering the financial transaction control, he supports them completely.
Mm-hmm.
Okay? So I care about who you support, and who you support in a way where you support them being lawless. You support them doing genocide. You support them engineering mass atrocity. And if you support all of that, you're totally on board for financial transaction control.
And do you think that Trump's position is ignorance or intentional in that regard?
So I think any candidate for the presidency operates in the world as it is, not in the way it ought to be.
Right.
And Trump has a bigger problem than just the dollar and 19 cents. He's got the red button problem. So I don't know if you remember, I told you the red button story, I think, the first time I was here.
Mm-hmm.
Do you remember the red button story?
I'm trying to recall, but I remember it being awesome.
Okay, so let me tell this again. So I was giving a speech to a group of people called Spiritual Frontiers Foundation, and they have a conference once a year on how we can help evolve our society spiritually. They're very well educated, very financially secure. Mm-hmm. And I'm in the middle of the speech, and I was describing the dark, the congressional testimony related to the Dark Alliance allegations. So about drug dealing by the U.S. intelligence agencies mm-hmm. into South Central L.A. and Mena, Arkansas. And during the testimony, a Department of Justice spokesperson told a reporter I was working with that the U.S. economy launders $500 billion to $1 trillion of illegal money as of fiscal 1998, making us the global leader in money laundering. So I said to this wonderful audience of spiritually evolved people, what would happen if we stop being the global leader in money laundering? And they said, well, you know, we might have trouble financing the government deficit, and our taxes might go up, and You know, and that money might leave and go to Hong Kong and Singapore and London instead of the New York Stock Exchange, and our IRAs and 401ks might go down. And I said, okay, let's pretend there's a big red button up on the lectern, and if you push that button, you can stop all hard narcotics trafficking in your neighborhood, your town, your state, tomorrow, thus offending the people who control $500 billion to $1 trillion thereon. Who here will push the button? And out of 100 people dedicated to evolving our society spiritually, only one would push the button. So I wouldn't let him talk. And I said, okay, why would you not push the button? And they said, we don't want our IRAs to go down. We don't want our government checks to stop, and we don't want our taxes to go up. And what I learned that day, the problem was not that they wouldn't push the red button. The problem was they wouldn't have an honest conversation about how do we turn the red button green? How do we make money pushing the red button? Because then we can push the red button. And everybody was frozen thinking, there's nothing I can do. I can't do anything. And I've got to worry about my kids and my family. And I don't want to start talking about drug dealing about, you know, by the U.S. intelligence agencies and the Bushes and the Clintons, because I could get myself in all a whole bunch of hot water. So nobody would have an honest conversation about how we turn the red button green. And that was the problem. Now, let's look at the election. So just as punishment for all his good work, we're going to make Gary the president. January 21st, you walk into the Oval Office and your Karl Rove political guy comes in and he says, you know, President Humble, congratulations. The American people have spent billions getting you elected and now they want their $1 billion tax subsidy for their plan in Tennessee. They want their Social Security increase. They want their defense contract. They want a community block grant to build a community center in their town. You know, they want, you know, that. And so you turn to your Secretary of Treasury and you say, Kevin, you know, we've got to get some money. And
yeah, Kevin, says, go print some money.
Go print. Well,
I got a little machine right here.
He's the Secretary of Treasury. If we wanted to have an honest currency, in fact, we would have Treasury issue the currency. And please note, every time a president has tried to issue the treasury, the currency from the treasury, they've had an assassination attempt or assassination, right?
Really?
Yes.
I didn't know that.
Let's get back to the framework after we finish this, and we'll get into that.
Huh.
So yeah, because there are two scams going on in the federal money, okay? If you say we have $35 trillion of debt, why? We don't need it. If Treasury had issued the money, they could have just issued $35 trillion in currency. There's no reason to have any debt. It's total fraud. Total fraud. And so we've issued $35 trillion of debt that we didn't need. We could have just issued the currency. But then we stole $21 trillion out the back door and more because we took the book secret after the $21 trillion got reported. Okay. So that's a 35 plus, you know, that's a $50 trillion fraud. And it's amazing how wealthy we are, you know, after.
Despite that, yeah.
Despite that, it's quite incredible.
I want to go back, though, to something you said
wait,
earlier.
Wait, I got to finish the red button story. Okay, so your Secretary of Treasury says, well, Mr. President, the American people don't want the red button pushed. And you better be nice to the people who control $500 billion to $1 trillion a year. As of 1998, it's much bigger now with a financial fraud, but they also control the $21 trillion that's been stolen out the back door, okay? And so if you're going to please your constituency, it's what the Idaho legislator said, your constituency wants the 19 cents, right?
Yep.
So you are, what is your power?
I don't know. You got me. Sounds like I'm in a pickle.
Yeah, you're in a pickle. And that's why the notion that we're going to vote our way out of this at a presidential level is absurd. Mm. Now, I think there's some very good people in Washington, in Congress, who are trying to at least bring transparency to these issues and show, you know, Massey keeps sponsoring a bill to eradicate the Department of Education, which I think is a great idea.
Yeah, same here.
Right. So there are some great people there, but we have to face the fundamental control system. We are being controlled by digital surveillance systems and information systems and media. We're being controlled by financial systems, nuts and bolts, and we're being financed by covert operations. And if we're going to turn this around, we have to face those controls and do something about it.
Well, with that said, I'm interested in your thoughts around. I heard you say more than once that you were seemingly okay with the fiat currency. In fact, you thought that the dollar was a well-governed. Right.
Read Alexander DeMars.
But it has more to do with the governance and the regulation of that fiat, yes, than the fact that it's a fiat currency.
Yes.
And so,
yes,
so what I heard you say, correct me if I'm wrong, you don't think, because I'm under the impression, and the folks that I listen to are saying, the dollar is going to crash. We are absolutely headed for catastrophe here in America. There's no going back. We are absolutely going to lose our reserve status, you know, globally. But it sounds like
I'm hearing you saying that
could be fixed. That could be resolved.
The dollar could be put back on a successful financial basis. That doesn't mean that it could maintain global reserve status. Mm. At this point, that is a military question. Mm. That is not a financial question. And that comes down to, from a military intelligence standpoint, can we protect our market share sufficiently to do so? I don't know. I would need far more access to military intelligence than I have. I mean, right now, I guess, but it's a guess.
All right. That makes sense.
So the dollar is much stronger than you think. And this notion that it's all going to collapse, I've been listening to this for 20 years. And for 20 years, I've been telling people it's not going to collapse. Now, what has been happening is we have been subsidizing our system by roaming around the world and engaging in plunder capitalism, shocking economies and taking resources cheap. Okay? And what we said as we've been, you know, going in Latin America and Eastern Europe and doing these shops and doing these plunders. There's a new series up at Solari. If you go to Solari and put in plunder capitalism or plunder, you'll get, you know, we're writing and publishing a lot on this. And what has been said is, you know, after we finish doing Latin America, we'll end up and we'll do the United States. Now, there's been a fair amount of plunder capitalism going on here, but nothing like what has been happening in other countries. Now it's coming here. And the way, you know, at the highest level, if you look at the entire global system, we have an unprecedented amount of organized crime and warfare. We have one host on the Solari Report who calls it the rackets. The rackets are taking such a big skim that you have only two ways of changing the current system. You can stop the rackets from taking so much money. You can run the system clean or you can depopulate. But if you want to keep racketeering at the same extent that you are today and soaking off so much value with the corruption that we have, you're going to have to depopulate. And that's exactly what is happening.
So the depopulation plan is connected to this, what's the better word for it? I'd never heard depopulation connected to...
Linked to the financial crisis.
Yeah.
So...
In the way you just did. Okay. So it allows them to continue... So the Bill Gates of the world, who've always been talking about depopulation,
right,
it's been fundamental to his entire strategy. I've always just thought that's a weird...
No.
He's got a weird God complex, but it's tied to financial thievery.
So when the money started to disappear from the federal government, basically... The Treasury is a laundering money out of our retirement accounts that's now disappearing out the back door,
mm-hmm,
okay? As that money started to go missing, I would make a big stink about the missing money and for year after year after year. And then I met Dr. Mark Skidmore, who I told you about his study, and he helped me do a survey. And that's when we established the baseline in 2021 that there was $21 trillion missing from DOD and HUD. $20 trillion from DOD, a trillion from HUD. And at that point, Mark said, why do you not give up on this issue? And I said, because this is an actuarial equation. If we don't deal with this, the only way they can balance the books is to depopulate, is to lower life expectancy. You have to lower life expectancy because you can't meet your retirement obligations, both pension obligations and health obligations.
But so I have a question, it may sound stupid, but why do they care whether they balance the book? I mean, they already don't show enough moral compunction to stop from stealing, so why would they care that the books balance at the end of the day?
Here's why. If you announce there's no money in Social Security, the money's disappeared, first of all, people will start looking and realize you've stolen it. Okay, that's number one. But number two, they'll all turn against you at the same time, right?
Well, you would think they would, but I thought they would have done that during COVID, and they all said, oh, no, just go along.
If you look at Social Security, you know, you get a mailing from Social Security. I think it comes every half year or year. And sure enough, the actuarial soundness has been mm-hmm. steadily going up as life expectancy is going down. Right. And the formula is working. It's working very, you know, they're doing it in a very fine-tuned way. And this is how they can meet their obligations. So they will meet their contractual obligations on Social Security. The way they're going to meet it is by lowering life expectancy and using inflation. So they will keep their contracts, but you will be living in dire poverty because you can't, you know, chicken's up 27% a year, but they will meet their contracts.
While eggs are 52%.
Right. Anyway, so they have to balance the books. I mean, obviously, once you get financial transaction control, then you don't have to do anything. You can take whatever you want.
Right.
So when Klaus Schwab says it's 2030 and you have no assets, you know, once you get financial transaction control, they're taking everything.
Final thoughts here, because we're coming to a close. I want to get your thoughts on, with everything you've said, because I want to tie this in to last week a little bit.
Can I just say one thing before you do that? Because I'm still trying to do the framework. The next time I'm coming with a map, and I'm going to... So nothing could be more wonderful than private currencies, particularly community currencies. And so I told you I'm a bit of a libertarian. If you look at how Bitcoin and cryptos are being used right now, you know, a lot of wonderful people are doing a lot of great things, but they're also being very much abused. And the potential to abuse them is tremendous, including stablecoin right now is being used to build a new market for U.S. treasuries. And it's just a way of expanding the dollar dominance. So, I mean, if you're managing the dollar system and you want to keep the rackets going, it's very clever. But it's exceptionally supportive of the dollar and dollar dominance. So I just wanted to get that in on private currencies.
Well, that's sort of where I was going, is where you saw Bitcoin sort of playing into, you know, if I guess what I'm saying is if you do believe that there's a crash coming, I mean, what would...
No, I believe there are shocks coming to centralize control of assets.
Fine.
It's not an economic collapse.
Okay.
It's a political... It's an economic war.
So then you're not, I guess, what I'm hearing you say is you're not a person that's telling folks, go buy gold and silver or go get Bitcoin to hedge your bets financially against what's coming.
Here's what I'm telling you.
I'm hearing
people.
You sort of say the opposite.
So I did a financial rebellion in 2022 called Where to Stash Your Cash in 2022. And I go through like 40 different things you can do. And then we did the same thing on the Slurry Report for Where to Stash Your Cash in 2024. What I will tell you is the most important thing you need to do, my favorite quote of the year is, the currency of the future will be relationships of trust. Mm. We are in a very serious political situation, and we are in what David Hughes calls an omni-war. Somebody's trying to kill us. Who are the people who you can trust, and who are the people who will watch your back? The thing you want to invest in are people. So the people who are going to be there for you, the people who are going to watch your back. Now, you want to be practical. You want to make sure you have resilience in all sorts of different ways. And the more you can get low integrity players out of your balance sheet and financial statement, the better. And if that means doing more for yourself, great. If it means hiring local companies to do it, great. Everybody's different. But there are no magic bullets. There is no financial product solution for a governance
for
problem.
Corruption, yeah.
Well, we have a group of people who are trying to kill us.
Yeah.
I mean, I just published an article called Musings on DOD, and I've got the video of Larry Fink talking about how we've created a model where we can build a successful, you know, we can build growing equity from a shrinking population. He's saying it.
What you said echoes a conversation I've had previously in terms of kind of marketing and branding, because that's a conversation right now, and not just money, but it's who can you trust, even when you think of media.
Right.
And I love the way you said, like, the most valuable thing moving forward is trust. And I think that's, I think we've talked about that on this podcast, is that the real essence of the value of a brand from here on out is going to be how much trust you can garner from those around you.
Right. Right. So I told you the story before when the litigation happened. You know, they basically targeted me. They're telling all sorts of lies in the media about me. And they're cutting off every form of credit or income. Boom, 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 boom. And suddenly, you know, I have $1 million a month overhead and no income and no credit. You know, and I had to take it down to $2,000 a month, which why learning to live around my Tennessee relatives is really helpful. they taught me all the old-timey ways. But it turned out I had lent or given $250,000 to friends and family who'd gotten in trouble because I was wealthy. And literally, I had a wealthy uncle who said, well, she helped everybody else, so we're going to help her. And over the next 11 years, so I litigated for 11 years. It was long. It was arduous. They repaid or gifted me back $250,000. And when I won the litigation, I got a whole bunch of money, and I sat down and calculated and did the settlement. And I realized it was a divine miracle.
Amen.
$250,000 had just come back. And my accountant, I'd had to bust a 401k and pay $225,000 in fees to get the rest for make compliance work that they stuck us with. And my accountant said, let's fund up the 401k. And I said, I'm never putting money into that. I'm never putting money back into that. And I'm never going into business with the federal government again. And I'm going to take that $500,000 and I'm going to bonus it back out on the People Bank to all the people who helped and supported me and trusted me or, you know, lent me money or whatever. And I did. I sent that money back out. And I said, because I knew they were going to come after me on the taxes. And I said, if I don't have it, they can't get it. But I learned if it hadn't been for that $250,000, I would never have made it. And it wasn't just that people lent or gave me the money back and so I had money to eat. It was that they could never corner and isolate me. They could never put me in a space where nobody believed me or trusted me. I was never alone. And I can't tell you, you know, we have to have an army, and you can't build an army just by throwing around money.
You're a modern day George Bailey. It's like It's a Wonderful Life.
No, I never ran a bank.
No, but what I mean by that is, that's what that whole... The whole building second community. Half of that, yeah, the second half of that movie's about that, and that's why.
Well, it's about
reached such a great conclusion because everybody's coming back in and giving their little cash here because of what George had put into the community.
Right. It's about building community, but it's also being committed to a culture of being productive, and being productive means people can have healthy families, in healthy homes, in healthy communities. You know, all of that.
Yep.
So,
wow, Catherine. I think that I learned a lot again.
That conversation got greatly expanded.
It really did.
Beyond the small boundaries we had set for it.
Well, I'm happy to discuss Bitcoin in small boundaries.
I know. I wish we could have you for longer or if you were more local that we could do this more often. But thank you for being here. I think one of the things I took away, Gary, and I've got to think about and investigate is this connection between depopulation and the financial system, the financial.
I've not thought about or heard that racket. Before. Yep.
That's why we're depopulating. I mean, I call it the great poisoning. It's on. Mm. And it's, you know, think of this not as, oh, the dollar's going to collapse or the system's going to collapse, but you have a parasite working its way through the system and it's going to try and eat you and take your stuff. Mm. So, you know, the collapse is not of the society or the economy. The collapse is of, you know, people who are targeted for that. So I just want to mention one thing because I brought you guys copies of this, which is up on our website. We're in the process of publishing, and I'll send it to you when it's done, really a very detailed roadmap of everything a state legislature can do to protect people from financial transaction control and to protect freedom. And as you know, the Constitution, what is not delegated to the federal government is reserved to the states. Mm-hmm. So if we can solve this $1.19 problem, there's enormous things that the states can do to protect financial transaction freedom. And I think there's an amazing opportunity. It makes me cry to see all this time spent on the presidential election and ignore the state elections. We just made a big hullabaloo on Money and Markets about your article after the Tennessee primaries about, you know, castigating people for not paying more attention.
Yep.
And, you know, so there is a tremendous opportunity if we can get people interested in supporting the good people in the state legislature and the state legislator protecting our financial transaction freedom. Yep. So
you will get the government you deserve.
No, I'm not getting the government I deserve. I deserve something better. So do you. But it's a little bit better
point.
Thanks to your efforts. I will
fair
say
point.
This.
Thanks, Catherine.
Okay, gentlemen,
thanks
thank you very
on.
Much.
Right.
If you'd like to learn more about Tennessee Stands, visit TennesseeStands.org to donate, volunteer, or get more information about what we're doing to preserve liberty for the people of Tennessee. You can also follow along on all social platforms at Tennessee Stands. As Thomas Paine reminded us, those who expect to reap the blessings of freedom must, like men, undergo the fatigue of supporting it.